I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. McDonald's, Walmart, Nestle, just a few of the multinational corporations that have promised to stop selling eggs from chickens kept in cages. Major brands also have promised to boycott pork from pregnant pigs kept in narrow cages known as gestation crates. And this spring, Purdue announced it will provide natural light and more space to the 700 million chickens it raises for meat every year, among other reforms. These companies are responding, they say, to consumer demand. Can the marketplace change the face of industrial farming? How much are Americans willing to pay for better treatment of animals? And do people agree on what is most humane? The economics of farm animal welfare. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you could join us. Hope you are staying relatively cool. Today we're going to talk about a controversial sector of the American food system, industrial livestock production, also known as factory farming. For decades, animal rights advocates have protested the way animals are treated on factory farms. They say many animals do not have enough room to exhibit natural behaviors, and they don't even have access to the outdoors. Advocates argue the way animals are killed is unnecessarily cruel, and that sick or unwanted animals are treated especially poorly. The industry response typically has been that the animals are not treated poorly. And as the population has grown, the argument goes, industrial livestock production has made it possible for consumers to buy food much more cheaply and thus given them a chance at a more varied diet. But over the last decade, the stalemate has shown some signs of easing. Corporations from General Mills to Pepsi to Starbucks have begun to require changes from their suppliers in the way animals are treated. What's driving them? They say they're responding to consumer demand. How do we explain this shift? How do most Americans feel about animal welfare in our food system? How is consumer demand for better animal welfare affecting the bottom line? My guest today will help us answer these questions. Bailey Norwood is an agricultural economist at Oklahoma State University and co-author of a book titled Compassion by the Pound, The Economics of Farm Animal Welfare. He joins us by phone from Oklahoma State. Bailey Norwood, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you are with us. And also with us is Matthew Prescott, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States. He's with us from a studio in Austin, Texas. Matthew Prescott, welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Bailey Norwood, you have done research on how consumers feel about animal welfare. What have you found?
Well, what I found is it's not simple. We found that people don't just want one thing when it comes to animal welfare. When you ask them how they want animals to be raised and how much they're willing to pay, they express different things depending on the setting and also depending how you ask them. But if I take all the literature, all the research I've done, and try to do my best summary of what people want, this is my summary. I found that a little less than one-third of the American public doesn't really care all that much about farm animals, but a little less than, say, two-thirds does care. They do care a good bit, and their main concern is that they just don't want the animals to suffer. And they are willing to pay, they're usually willing to pay the premiums that it takes for the animals not to suffer. And there's also a small percentage of Americans who go one step further, and they not only want animals, livestock, not to suffer, they want them to be happy and have a content life. But those are generally much fewer people. You got to keep in mind there's a difference when we're thinking about how much people are willing to pay for higher standards of care. There's sometimes a big difference between what it costs at the farm to provide better levels of animal care and the price difference that consumers see at the store. And the final thing I'd say about them is that it's surprisingly hard to figure out exactly what it is consumers want, because when you look at their behavior in a grocery store, they're uninformed consumers, and so you're getting an uninformed thing of behavior. But and so if you, when we do research and we say, well, let's inform these people and then see what they do, well, now they're in a research setting, and people behave very different in research settings. So it's hard. It's not easy answering a question of what it is that people want.
I want to clarify a couple of things. First, that last point, when you say people behave differently in a research setting, does that mean that people say kind of what they're more high-minded, they're
exactly.
They don't actually describe what they'll do in a store?
Exactly. Yes, they tend to do things that make themselves look better, and they do it even in things like internet and telephone surveys.
I'm sorry, explain that.
Well, you know, think about it this way. When you survey people and ask them questions like, would you pay so-and-so more for cage-free eggs? Most people say yes. And when we even bring people into experiments and have them use their own money to bid on, say, cage and cage-free eggs, and if you looked at their behavior in surveys and in experiments, you would expect that most eggs in the world would be cage-free eggs because that's what people are saying they want in experiments and surveys.
But and that's what they're saying they're willing to pay for.
Yes, yes. But when you go to the grocery store, cage-free eggs are, I think, just like 5 to 10% of all egg sales.
Okay, I want to pick up on that, too. But Matthew Prescott, let me ask you for your view on all this, your impression of where consumer attitudes are, and if you have answers to any of the conundrums that Bailey Norwood just laid out.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Norwood was commissioned at Oklahoma State, I think back in 2005, by the American Farm Bureau Federation, which represents all kinds of farmers all across the country, to study this very question, exactly how do the American consumers feel about the treatment of animals on farms. And Dr. Norwood's study for the Farm Bureau found that 95% of people want animals in the food supply to be treated well. And he's right that that doesn't always correlate to their purchases at the grocery store. However, increasingly it does. And importantly, when people are at the grocery store, they may be thinking they're buying a cage-free egg when in fact they're not. You know, we found a farm last year that was labeling eggs from chickens confined in cages so small they can't even spread their wings, never seeing the light of day, never touching grass, never even able to get out of their cages, found eggs from that system sold in a package depicting free-range chickens roaming in a green field in front of a red barn. And so that's what consumers are seeing when they go to the grocery store, and it isn't representative of what's actually happening at the farm level, and so it isn't really representative of their own values when they buy those products.
What about the point that that Professor Norwood made about people don't necessarily behave in a commercial situation in a store the way they describe themselves as behaving when they're talking to a researcher?
I think that's certainly true, though I think the greater issue here is just lack of information at the store level. When you are talking to a researcher, they're giving you information like, you know, would you rather, you know, how much more would you pay for a carton of eggs if you knew that the chickens weren't locked inside tiny barren cages so small they can't even spread their wings and where they live lives of deprivation, versus when you're in a grocery store and you see those very eggs, but they come with a misleading label. So I think it's probably a combination of both. But increasingly, more and more people, millions of people, countless people all across the country, are seeking out these more humane products. They are seeking to avoid products from the worst types of factory farms. In fact, in 2007, when Burger King became one of the first major companies to announce that it would be, for example, starting to buy some cage-free eggs and pork from pig producers that don't lock their animals in crates, they received more unsolicited positive customer feedback about that announcement than they ever had about any other corporate announcement in the entire history of the Burger King Corporation. And I think that still stands today, that animal welfare generated more positive feedback from their customers than any other announcement they've ever made.
Well, does it follow from what both of you have said, Bailey Norwood, let me ask you this, does it follow that producers now have a financial incentive. The corporations doing factory farming have a financial incentive to insist that animals are treated well?
Yes, in some respect. And let me also back up something that Matt said. What we have found in our experiments that when you ask people what percent of the eggs you buy are cage-free eggs and things like that, we found that a lot of people think they're buying cage-free eggs when they're not. So a lot of times, Matt's right, they're not really sure what they are purchasing. And now back to your more recent question. You kind of have two things going on when a company is looking at animal welfare standards and finance. One is a company can try to get ahead of the curve and sell a more humane product and reach that small niche of growing niche of consumers and be able to charge a higher price and make some more money. But I think a lot of things we've seen recently is companies trying to avoid a consumer backlash, avoid being shamed in public, just trying to keep up. You know, people are becoming more concerned with animals, and I think companies are trying to keep up with it. So they're trying to just not fall behind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense to me. That is Bailey Norwood of Oklahoma State University and an economist there here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Matthew Prescott, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States. And you can be part of this conversation. Do you think about animal welfare when you're buying your groceries? I mean, how much would you be willing to spend to support humane treatment of animals? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. It sounds as if there's a lot of imprecision, both about what consumers know in the store, but also is it clear in research what people mean by humane treatment? Bailey Norwood?
Well, it depends. In many ways, yes. Like, there is certainly a lot of agreement that, say, animals should be able to turn around. They should have a decent, comfortable place to lie down. Basic things like that. If you start asking things about whether they should, what types of natural behaviors they should be able to express, like should be able to they be able to breed naturally or something like that, there you get into more disagreements. But I think for the most of the big controversies we have right now, like battery cages and gestation crates, most consumers are agreed that they don't like the cages, that they want animals to have more room.
I'm gonna turn to Matthew Prescott and ask you to define those two terms that Bailey Norwood just used. A battery cage is what?
Yeah, battery cages and gestation crates are basically tiny restrictive cages that the egg and the pork industries use, respectively battery cages in egg production and gestation crates in pork production, to immobilize animals. In battery cages, picture a cage about the size of a file cabinet drawer, and inside that cage there are 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe even 9 or 10 birds locked up for their entire lives, which is over 1 year, never able to get out. So if you could imagine opening a file cabinet drawer, putting in 5 to 10 even birds, closing it, and then leaving them in there for a year, that's what a battery cage is in egg production. And that today represents about 95% of all egg production in the entire country. In pork production, gestation crates are essentially Iron Maidens for pigs. They confine animals so narrowly that the animal can't even turn around inside that cage. A pig's body is, roughly the same width of the crate itself, and so they can maybe take a step forward or a step backward, but they can't even turn their own bodies around. And pigs live in those cages basically for 4 years on end. They live in that crate, in that cage, while they're pregnant for many months. They're moved to a different cage to give birth. They're reimpregnated and put back in that cage again. And the cycle repeats for over 4 years. It's probably the worst possible way to confine animals ever invented.
And you're saying it is still the norm. You said the battery cages are the norm still in chicken production, and gestation cages are the norm in pork production in the U.S.?
unfortunately, today they are the norm. These industries, over a period of many decades, really converted almost 100% of their industries, egg production and pork production, to these forms of cage confinement. And so that's what we've got today. But it's changing. You know, as you mentioned earlier, companies like Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King, Kroger, Albertsons, the largest food companies on the planet, are demanding something better from their suppliers because they know that their customers want something better. They're saying, we're in the next few years, we're only going to be selling cage-free eggs. We're getting rid of gestation crates from our pork supply. And for to their credit, for the most part, the producers are converting. They're finding ways of producing pork without the use of gestation crates and eggs without the use of battery cages. And lo and behold, in some of these cases, they're actually reaping financial benefits. There was an article in a magazine called National Hog Farmer. I'm sure many readers are familiar, or many listeners are familiar with it, of course.
I'll tell you what. Hold the news from the National Hog Farmer publication while we take this quick break, and you can tell us when we come back. I also want to remind our listeners that we'd love you to be part of this conversation. How much are Americans willing to pay for better treatment of animals? Do people agree on what is humane? We're discussing the economics of farm animal welfare. You can be part of this conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. This spring, Purdue announced it will provide natural light and more space to the 700 million chickens it raises for meat every year, among other reforms. What's driving Purdue and other companies to make changes in how they raise animals, how they treat animals? Consumer demand for better animal welfare standards is what the companies say. Joining me to discuss how this is playing out is agricultural economist Bailey Norwood of Oklahoma State and Matthew Prescott, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can call us at 410-662-8780. Matthew Prescott, when we took a break, you were telling us that the norms of pig and chicken production are changing in the U.S., and you were about to give us a headline from, I think you said, Hog Farm News.
Yeah, National Hog Farmer, everybody's favorite magazine, I'm sure. National Hog Farmer just released an article about pig producers that are getting rid of these tiny, restrictive, inhumane gestation crates that found that when they are raising pigs instead of in these crates in open groups and open pens, they're actually able to save money. The farmer cited in that article is saving, I think, like $40,000 a year in feed costs by not confining pigs in crates. And so I think from an economic perspective, you know, a lot of the time the factory farming industry will kind of hem and haw over having to make animal welfare changes. But farmers are an innovative group of people, and when the demand is there, there'll be a great many of them who want to meet that demand for more humane production and find a way to do it with keeping profits in mind.
Let me pick up on that with Professor Norwood. Bailey Norwood, you said something in your very first answer to me that I did. I can't quote verbatim, but it seemed to me you were indicating that the prices in the grocery store wouldn't have to go up as much, or at least I wasn't sure whether you're saying they wouldn't have to go up as much as the cost of better animal welfare moves in raising animals, or whether you were just saying that those numbers wouldn't be shocking to consumers.
Right. What I was trying to say there is, and I'll give you an example, that when you compare, say, cage-free to cage eggs, cage-free eggs probably only cost about 40 cents more per dozen to produce, and so that's not a lot. But if you go into a grocery store, cage-free eggs are usually, the last time I put numbers together, they cost about $1.50 more per dozen, each. And so the difference between the price difference for cage-free eggs that you see at the farm and the retail sector is can often be very different. And I think if the price of cage-free eggs would come down closer to that, to the extra cost of producing cage-free eggs, then you'd see a lot more people buying it. But, you know, the reason you have that difference is that a lot of grocery stores, they're going to target, if they can sell cage-free eggs, they're going to say, well, we can target these towards this specific group of often elite consumers, and we can charge them a higher price. And also, cage-free eggs, especially for kind of like natural food stores or Whole Foods, they're going to have a different distribution system that may be more costly.
So, okay, but you're talking about a pricing decision at retail, and I'm curious, but I actually don't want to take time right now to ask you to tell us how much of that shows up in the producers' pockets, because there's lots of people who want to be part of this conversation, and
sure.
So I want to pull some of them into it. Whitney has called us from Baltimore. Whitney, welcome to the show.
Hi there. So I have a question for Bailey about whether or not the slaughter methods, changing those specifically with Purdue, having the chickens basically be brain dead by the time they reach the slaughterhouse versus having them alive and having their throat slit and basically being conscious in front of all the other animals in line behind them, whether or not there will be, you guys forecast, a greater demand for people demanding the slaughter methods changed in the meat they're producing.
Whitney, I appreciate you raising the question, because I have to say I'm apparently not a well enough informed consumer to know when I pick up a package of chicken in the grocery what the slaughtering method was. Matthew Prescott, how would you respond to Whitney?
Yeah, unfortunately, you don't need to be informed as a consumer on this issue, because essentially every chicken and most turkeys in this country are slaughtered in the same way, which is this terribly outdated, archaic method where birds are, they come into the slaughterhouse in these crates from the farm, and they're just really haphazardly dumped into a pile. Workers grab them while they're still alive. They snap them upside down into these shackles. They move across this fast-moving line where their throats are cut, and they bleed out, and they end up in this tank of scalding hot water. But the whole process is just so old and outdated that it's really ineffective. Most birds, by some reports, end up having their throats cut while they're conscious, not to be too graphic. Millions of them may end up in the scalding tank while they're still alive and able to feel pain. And that's how almost every single chicken and turkey in this country is killed today. Purdue, in its more recent announcement, did make some initial moves toward refining that method, replacing it with a newer method that's being used in Europe and elsewhere that avoids a lot of those animal welfare problems we currently see in slaughterhouses. And so that's a really positive move. It's a very initial step, and Purdue is the only company in the country taking it right now. So hopefully we'll see more.
Bailey Norwood, let me ask you about what Whitney's question about the way Purdue will be slaughtering its chickens, at least some of its chickens. It seems to me, it wasn't clear to me from the announcement, which I don't have in front of me to quote from, but it wasn't clear to me that this was going to apply to all of their meat chickens. Will people know? I mean, will this become, do you expect, as an agricultural economist, do you expect this will become a fact point on which consumers will make a judgment standing at the meat counter?
Well, you know, a slaughtering method that a company uses, they're probably not going to advertise it on their egg cartons. That's not something you want to even raise in the grocery store.
And these are meat chickens we're talking about, not the laying chickens.
Same with the laying chickens. You know, I'm sorry, same with the meat chickens. People aren't just, they're just not going to advertise that kind of thing. But what it could do, if using the slaughtering method gets them less negative publicity, then it might have an impact.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Bailey Norwood, agricultural economist at Oklahoma State University, and Matthew Prescott, senior food policy director for the Humane Society of the United States. We're talking about changes in the way some farm animals are raised, more humane treatment of farm animals. You can be part of the conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or a phone call to 410-662-8780. Amy is calling us from Seattle, Washington. Amy, thanks for the call.
Yes, hi, Sheila, thank you.
And your question?
Yes, this question is for both Bailey and Matt. As a consumer, you know, once I learned how bad the treatment was for the animals and factory farms, I greatly reduced my meat consumption for my family and even eggs. But it doesn't seem like, you know, that's enough, and I don't know what else to do. Of course, I'm horrified the more I read about what happens to animals in factory farms, and hearing you guys talk about it in the accounts of what you know in your work, it's just so eye-opening. And, of course, anybody I know would be horrified by what really happens. But, of course, as you said, Matt, the labels don't indicate what really happened. So what else can I do as a consumer for my family and for the animals and the environment?
Amy, I appreciate you raising the question. And Matt, I'll throw it to you, but let me also underline a point that I glean from Amy's question. She said the first thing she said was that she and her family have reduced how much meat they eat. So in a way, she is less of a player in the consumption of meat products than she might have been a couple of years ago. And how does that affect things also, Matt?
Yeah, well, the least profitable type of product to make is the kind that people don't want to buy. And we see now millions of people all over the country doing exactly what Amy out in Seattle and her family are doing in eating fewer of these products. In fact, it's been quantified. There was a Mintel report recently that said 36% of Americans are now eating meat alternatives regularly. The USDA reported that we're eating collectively in aggregate as Americans 12% less meat now today than we were just a few years ago. And so, you know, to Amy's question, what more can be done? At the Humane Society, we advocate a program called the 3 R's, which means reduce, refine, and replace, reducing the amount of meat and eggs and dairy that we're consuming by replacing it with more plant-based proteins, more veggie burgers and black bean burgers and almond milk and products like that, and then refining the animal products left in our diet to avoid the worst factory farming practices, switching to higher welfare egg products like cage-free and free-range, for example.
Amy, I appreciate your posing the question. Tom has called us from Baltimore. Tom, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Hey, I have a question, and I was curious how other countries handle their slaughter methods. And I just want to say, you know, I'm a vegetarian and I've been it for 30 years. And whenever I hear about people cutting back on meat, I just sort of have to laugh because it's not solving any problem. I mean, you're still, you know, eating meat and there's still animals are being killed. And the only way to do something about it is actually become a vegetarian.
Well, that's an interesting assertion. Bailey Nord, I'd like to ask you about Tom's question. I'd like to throw his question about how other countries handle this. Can you give us some insight into that? Is it different in Europe?
I really can't tell you much at all about how other countries slaughter animals.
Matt,
I really don't know.
Matt Prescott, is that something you've looked at?
Yeah, in the UK, for example, about 25% of chickens and 75% of turkeys are slaughtered using this newer, more humane method. It's called controlled atmosphere stunning, where basically the animals are rendered unconscious and then dead before they're ever really even handled by workers. So it avoids a lot of the animal welfare pitfalls. So it's about a quarter of chickens, three quarters of turkeys. Throughout Europe, the system is widely used as well. Here in the U.S., we're just so outdated on this topic that we're still using, like, the most archaic method devised. But, you know, the caller, you know, I think that there are a lot of people who share the caller sentiments, and they are becoming vegetarian or vegan. But I do think that there are, you know, there are even more people who want to play a role and are doing things like Meatless Monday, or they're doing things like Vegan Before 6, Mark Bittman's program, where you basically eat a vegan diet until 6 p.m. and then after that all bets are off. And that's, so, you know, for every vegetarian or vegan, there are countless more people that are, you know, doing these things like Meatless Monday or Vegan Before 6 or you know, a flexitarian diet where they're just being more conscious about incorporating more plant-based foods into their diet.
Well, Bailey Norwood, let me ask you to cast your agricultural economist eye on the assertion that Tom made, that it really doesn't count unless you go completely vegetarian or vegan. In terms of the economic impact, wouldn't two people cutting back kind of count like somebody going vegetarian?
Well, yeah, I mean, if something is bad, whether it's the way an animal treated or pollution or something, and you cut back on it, that would be a good thing. You know, it's just a matter of degree. But, you know, I'd also add that if we're talking about changing how we eat versus going vegetarian, I would also say spend some time looking into the differences in the livestock production systems. You know, there's a big difference in how, say, pork and beef are raised. And someone may look at beef production and conclude it's a pretty humane system, and they could end up eating more meat, and based on their beliefs, if it's mostly beef, they might conclude that they're actually doing a lot of good for animals.
Can you tell us in a sentence or two what it is about beef production in the U.S. that is more humane than pork production?
Sure. Yeah, well, the first thing is you don't have these really small cages.
Okay.
You know, you're not going to have these bad pictures that consumers don't like to see. Cattle are going to start off. They're going to be born mainly in pastures, and they're going to stay in pastures for a large part of their life. And even when they get to a stage that we call the feedlot stage, that's when they are taken out of the pastures and put in smaller lots, and they're no longer eating grass, but they are eating hay and lots of corn. And those don't look as good, but they're not crammed together. And they're not in small cages. They can move, they can walk around, and they get this food that they absolutely love. And so at every part of the beef production stage, I think you can make credible claims that it's a pretty humane process.
Jeff is calling us from Baltimore County with a question I was hoping we would get to. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Yes. I guess if we make a choice and we say we don't want to eat beef that's raised in a CAFO, that we want beef that's going to be grass-fed and more humanely treated and then more humanely slaughtered. One of the problems, and it's been reported on NPR recently, there's rampant fraud going on. So you'd be willing to pay an upcharge, and then it turns out it's mislabeled and it's really not authentically what you feel you're getting. That was in the recent book, Real Food, Fake Food, that they had on NPR, and I have big concerns about that.
Right, it's a practice called greenwashing, disinformation about how environmentally enlightened a product is. Bailey Norwood, do we have any way of protecting against it? It's the same thing you were talking about. I think it was you who talked about the cage-free eggs the eggs that are not cage-free but somehow are marketed to look like they are.
Right. And the only real way around it, I think, is just becoming more educated. Instead of just going to the store and just responding to words like, you know, natural and just humane, you do have to go into, do a little looking into what the words mean, how the animal, and look into the organizations and see how the animals are raised. But we also, another thing we have working on our side is different types of activist organizations that are trying to hold people accountable.
But Matthew Prescott, we don't really have a seal of approval kind of thing the way, for example, organic foods, there are standards of what makes an organic what constitutes an organic food that for that claim to be made, it might be made, as our caller Jeff said, fraudulently. But there would be a way of looking into that and enforcing. Do we have that with humane treatment of animals?
Well, there are independent certifications out there, and some are more credible than others, but generally programs like Certified Humane, which is a label, or Animal Welfare Approved, which is another label, Global Animal Partnership, these are credible programs that can give consumers some degree of assurance that the animals on farms are at least being treated with a minimum degree of respect, and they're independently audited. These are programs that actually go onto the farm and audit to make sure that the claims are being met. Again, some of them are more credible than others, and it does take a little bit of research. When it comes to eggs, we have a website, egglabels.com. It's just really simple, egglabels.com, that helps consumers navigate what the different labels are and what they actually mean.
Egglabels.com. Okay, we need to take another quick break here. Lots more to talk about the way animals are being raised and whether they are indeed being raised more humanely. When we come back, more on how and why the food industry giants like McDonald's and Nestle are changing their animal welfare practices. Join the conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. Or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with agricultural economist Bailey Norwood of Oklahoma State and with Matthew Prescott, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States. We're talking about humane treatment of farm animals, the trend in that direction, what people are willing to pay for food that they feel has been treated humanely. You can join this conversation. Send an email to midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. We got an email from Sally, who sort of picks up on where we were. She says, I only buy cage-free eggs, look for cage-free chicken, but I have a hard time finding it at my local grocery store. If a meat product is labeled organic and cage-free, I would buy that before any other. What is the industry doing? We talked about independent certification, but she asks, what is the industry doing to address labeling of meat products? Bailey Norwood?
Well, the industry is certainly, you know, they're mainly going to be putting on labels that help them sell things, and so they're going to be putting on some labels that just make you want to buy things. They're also trying to communicate some things about them. They also have to comply with certain laws about what's on the labels. But if she's asking, like, what is the industry doing about communicating exactly how animals are raised, then I'd say, you know, very, very little. That if you're producing a product that you think is better than all the rest and is humane, you're going to put that all over your label. If you're not one of those, you're not going to want to say much. You're going to just want to say something like all natural or something like that. I'm not sure if that's what she was asking, though.
Well, it was an email, so I can't ask her whether that answers her question. But it sounds like you're saying you have to kind of read. Consumers kind of have to read between the lines that if the claim isn't made, it's probably because there's not a basis for making it.
Yeah, and you know, consumers also need very active groups who are looking into these labels and raising a fuss when people are being deceived. Because, you know, most consumers, we have lots of things on our minds. We've got very busy lives. And in addition to farm animal welfare, we've got the whole world that's full of things that we care about. And so you can't really expect every consumer to do research on every little thing that they're concerned about. But that's why we have so many nonprofit groups and university organizations and things like that to help check into it and do research for us.
Rebecca has a question. She's calling us from Atlanta. Rebecca, Atlanta, Georgia. Rebecca, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I also try to talk with people about reducing the amount of meat consumption and then possibly when they would like to eat meat, during those times, trying to purchase from a better source, better treated farm animals. And the question I often get is, how do the majority of Americans afford to do that, even when the are eating it less often, when they want to eat it, they have to pay more for that better quality, more humanely raised meat. And so the question that I'm asking is, what might people recommend for telling these others to ask that?
In other words, what is the answer? You're hoping there is an answer to how, if this becomes, if these more humane methods, which cost somewhat more, become standard, how will American consumers be able to pay for the resulting array of animal products that are presented to them in the grocery store?
Correct, as we're going through this transition, because it will take a while, obviously.
Matthew Prescott, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, there are a couple of different answers, and well, really, there's a different answer depending on, you know, who you are as a consumer. But, you know, a lot of times improving animal welfare doesn't really come with a big price tag. I mentioned that National Hog Farm article, which found
you did that mention that.
Yeah, there are pig producers that are actually saving money by getting pigs out of gestation crates. There was a study conducted by the United Egg Producers, the chief lobby organization for the egg industry, representing about 90% of all egg farmers. They did an economic analysis looking at the cost of raising chickens in a cage versus a cage-free environment, and they found that it's only about a penny per egg more to produce an egg in a cage-free environment. More recent analyses show that it adds about 50 cents a month onto the average family's grocery bill to switch to cage-free eggs, looking just at the actual production costs. And so a lot of the times these things don't come with huge price tags. But, you know, many consumers, that's why they're eating fewer eggs, drinking less milk, eating less meat, because typically plant-based foods are more affordable. You know, meat and milk and eggs are really resource-intensive to produce. The most efficient source of meat only converts around 11% of feed energy into human food, because we're funneling, you know, growing all these crops and funneling them through animals to produce protein, whereas we can just take crops directly and produce plant-based proteins out of them. And so a lot of people wanting to save money, either just period or to be able to afford, you know, more, more expensive types of meat products, are eating more plant-based foods for lunch and for dinner every day to try and balance that out.
I think that's Rebecca, thank you for the question. I think Brian from Washington, D.C. wants to pick up on exactly that. Brian, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, everyone. I'm really enjoying the conversation so far. And my question has changed because now there's all this talk, both sides are making mention of people moving away from meat products to eating more vegetarian or vegan plant foods, I guess. And I'm just wondering, is this affecting the industry itself, where the producers are also going to move away from eggs or meat because they're seeing this growing demand?
Bailey Norwood, I hadn't thought of that connection. What do you make of it? It seems as if Brian is positing a situation in which many consumers will reduce the amount of animal protein or animal products that they want to eat. I mean, are you seeing a reshaping of industrial farming in that direction?
Not really. I mean, meat production is still, meat consumption is still high. And plus, you've got all these emerging markets around the world. You know, as China gets richer, it wants more and more meat. So even if Americans started turning away from meat, I think you may still find a pretty big market for meat. If it's okay, I'd like to add something about the cost of better animal care. I think overall it does cost more to treat animals better. That cost may come down as we learn more about these alternative systems. But if it ever, like Matt mentioned, the case where this one study where they found that raising hogs without gestation crates lowered the cost of production, if that ever ended up being the case and that was a real finding and people believed it, then there is no more issue. If it's ever cheaper to raise animals better and more humane, producers are going to do it whether we ask them to or not.
Right. I did want to ask you, as an economist, I did want to get your views as an economist about Matthew Prescott's description that there are some ways of humane treatment that cost less. I mean, Matthew Prescott, if you're cramming currently five or six or eight chickens into a space the size of a file cabinet drawer, it's got to cost more to give them the space to move naturally. No, I mean we'll be kidding ourselves if we think we can get to humane treatment without paying more.
Well, it depends. You know, in the case of pork production, for example, these gestation crates that we use now across the industry to confine pigs, these are products of like the 1960s, using 1960s technology, which is basically, you know, they're basically hunks of metal plopped down in what amounts to an airplane hangar. And, you know, using 2016, 21st century technology, we can raise animals in a more humane manner and also tend to save money. There are, for example, forms of pig housing and pig feeding called, there's one called electronic pig feeding that is a 21st century way of feeding pigs individually portioned, rationed amounts of food. That wasn't available in 1960s when gestation crates were invented. And lo and behold, not only is it more humane, but it actually saves the producer on feed costs. And if you're a pig producer raising pigs, you know, the pigs themselves are cheap. It's the feed that's expensive. And so that savings can really add up. And that's why we're seeing, you know, companies like McDonald's and Burger King and so many others that are getting rid of gestation crates in their pork supply chain, able to do that without charging consumers even a penny more for that pork.
We are down to just a few minutes, and I'd like to get a sense from each of you, Bailey Norwood, starting with you. What do you think these industrial operations are going to look like in 10 or 20 years? Can these operations do what animal rights advocates would like them to do and still be a profitable industry?
I wonder about that all the time, and I'm not shying away from the question. I really don't know. I know two things. One, I know is that the movement HSUS is leading is working with consumers. People are certainly becoming more concerned about these things. And so, in 20 years, I wouldn't be surprised if we look back and there were no more gestation crates and no more battery cages, very few small cages at all. Wouldn't surprise me at all. But at the same time, a lot of these production technologies are located in states that have a lot of political power, and it would be hard to force change, at least politically, and I don't know how much that change could come about through non-political means. So my answer is I see either way, and I'm personally conflicted. I don't know which way it's going to go.
Well, I thought sort of the tenor of our conversation, and I should have asked you directly, I thought it was consumer demand, not regulation, that's moving this along. Do I have the wrong impression?
No, that's right. That's where the progress is mostly being made. How far it'll go, I'm just not sure. But it wouldn't surprise me if in 20 years we didn't have any gestation crates. And in 50 years, I would say we wouldn't have any. 20, I'm not so sure.
Matthew Prescott, I'll give you the last word if you can give us some vision of where you think this is heading and how fast.
Yeah, I think that it's heading exponentially in a better and better direction. You know, we've got Walmart, McDonald's, all the biggest food companies saying no more cages, no more crates. We're going 100% cage-free. We're getting rid of these crates. And that's huge progress, and it's going to completely transform these industries. It doesn't mean that meat and egg production will be cruelty-free by any means. And so I still think on top of that, we'll continue seeing a major shift toward more plant-based proteins. You know, NASDAQ published an article last year called The Death of Meat, advising investors to avoid having long investments in meat production companies because it just can be risky. And so I do think that these industries will continue trying to stay ahead of that by treating animals better as consumers demand it more. And I think we'll see more consumers eating more plant-based foods as well.
Very interesting conversation. I'm grateful to you both. Thank you so much. Bailey Norwood, agricultural economist at Oklahoma State University and co-author of Compassion by the Pound, The Economics of Farm Animal Welfare. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Matthew Prescott, Senior Food Policy Director of the Humane Society of the United States. Thanks.
Thanks, Sheila.
And again, the website that Matthew Prescott mentioned to learn about egg labeling, egglabels.com. Also want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes, open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on the weekends, on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow for an hour on how to start a revolution in your garden. That's tomorrow. Maybe in this heat, it's better to talk about gardening better than doing it. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay cool.